Communication Untangled with Sue Keogh.
Episode 2, Untangling Menus.
The day after recording this interview, I was on a flight from London to Gran Canaria. I could hear the food and drinks trolley coming and started leafing through the in-flight magazine, looking at what was on offer. It's loud, I'm sitting by the window, and I have to lean across the other passengers to talk to the air hostess. But happily, the way the menu is laid out made it really easy to order. Lots of pictures, I didn't need to be able to speak the same language, and the meal deals made the pricing really easy too. All I had to do was smile and tap at what I wanted. So she understood what I was after, and I got my gin and tonic, so everybody was happy. And no one understands more about the psychology of designing a menu than Sean Willard from the Menu Engineers. He's got over 2 decades in the restaurant trade, starting out in a steakhouse at the age of 18. He went on to study at Cornell's prestigious hotel school and was mentored by Greg Rapp, who laid the foundations for the techniques the menu engineers use today. We talk about the huge shifts in menu design in this post-pandemic era and why every restaurant should have an item on the menu that lets you really blow the budget. I started off by asking Sean what difference even a menu's material makes to the whole dining experience.
It can set the expectation for the entire interaction that you're about to have with the restaurant, from the curb to, you know, what's that hook that the restaurant has that gets you talking about something like, oh, that sounds really good. What is that one thing that they're able to showcase and help you find quickly? That tactile feel when you sit down and you're handed a menu, even when it's digital, that user experience feel on the digital side just sort of sets that expectation.
Those elements like, is it a really lovely textured sort of paper that's really lovely to touch, or sometimes a really plasticky one that's actually a bit sticky from the previous diners? These things can all put you off, can't they?
Absolutely. You know, caring for that menu is so important, like you said about the sticky menu. And sometimes I work on menu projects and I get so surprised that I've been presented dirty menus when we're going to update the menus. And it's just sort of telling for me of the team that's working there, you know, how much care and attention they put into someone who's putting a magnifying glass up to your menu. To me, the restaurant can embody an entire organization's culture, right? That care for a menu. It's that one primary vehicle that we're using to communicate to our guests. So what do we want our guests to see? What do we want them to hold, touch and feel about our restaurant? That's, you know, one of those touch points that's such an important part of it. And it varies. You know, a lot of this sometimes is dictated by where we are, whether we're in maybe a fast, casual, quick service environment, more counter service where you're reading a menu board, all the way up to fine dining where you're holding more of a leather-bound book maybe, or a corkboard type menu. It's a fascinating way for the restaurant to encapsulate something. You know, they're working on the culinary side, but how do we now put this ideas and concepts into someone's hand?
Let's say I give you a brief. I say, I'm a really high-end restaurant. I need to get across the idea that this food is quality, it's beautiful ingredients. Then what are those things that you're in the back of your mind? You're already thinking, right, okay, well, we need to use this layout, this font, these colors. You know, what are those things that you're already getting working on mentally?
When we start to say high-end, I think we almost revert back to a little bit more nostalgia to it, right? You wouldn't really want to see as many digital touch points in a high-end restaurant. You're going to want the tactile feel of a printed menu. Sometimes you want a little bit of weight either to the paper, if it's more of a paper menu, or it's, you know, in a cover or jacket. But it also goes both ways. I've been to plenty of nice restaurants. They have a nice, like a parchment paper that's folded, you know, it's printed with their logo and name on it, but it's really almost like a one-time use kind of menu. So it doesn't necessarily mean that something has to be expensive for it to have a unique and special experience that feels elevated.
And then equally, if I said to you, okay, I'm offering a bit more of a budget restaurant where I want lots of families to come along and eat, more of a sort of diner experience, then what would you be thinking there? How would you get across that idea that it's great food, but it's going to be a slightly lower budget?
On that menu, you know, this is kind of a good time to talk about how we would price items. You'd expect the pricing structure to be different at more of a family-friendly restaurant type you mentioned before, which was a little bit higher end. You'd almost expect whole dollar pricing there. That doesn't have sense at the family friendly type restaurant. You'd expect maybe like a $4.95, or, you know, beverages, they're not $3 whole, it's $2.95 for that beverage. And if you had that same pricing structure, let's say at that high end restaurant, you know, you went to the cocktail bar and they had a cocktail for $15.95, that would feel off brand for them. Also, I would encourage those restaurants that are angling more towards families to make it easier for those families to order. bundle things into orders for two and things that are easy to share at the table, you know, if the family's getting a couple of entrees.
Yeah, I'm picturing a really busy family with the kids knocking everything over and needing to go to the toilet. So that's such a good point, because you need to just look at it quickly whilst also stopping a child from causing some sort of mayhem and just go, right, I want that and I want that. You're not taking the time to peruse it, are you?
Absolutely. And we want to make it easy. And sometimes, you know, we talk about different personality profiles that have to interact with this one document that is the menu. And there's so many different personality types, but someone who's there either on business too can be so engaged in the conversation if they're trying to close a deal or they're very focused on client relations at that time, they're less focused about the menu. They may be in the same boat as that family of four who have two kids running around and have very little time to look at the menu. So even for those types of guests, how do we make that a very quick and fast decision-making time when they're focused on something else?
Thinking about it as well, then you've got more images as well, haven't you? So a child can just point at the menu and say, right, I'll have that one, I'll have that burger. But then if I was in a high-end restaurant, then I wouldn't necessarily, you know, I'd expect to be treated like an adult who can visualize what gnocchi might look like, for example. Is that something you think about as well when you're putting these menus together?
Absolutely, yeah. Pictures are definitely put you in a certain category, or, you know, in people's minds. It would feel odd if you walked into a high-end steakhouse that did have pictures on the menu. It would feel off-brand for them. Pictures are great in other areas like travel hubs, you know, for concessionaires at train stations, airports. Pictures can be a really effective tool when there's a bit of a language barrier. So there are times when we work with restaurants that are not just bilingual or trilingual, but, you know, they're serving the global community wherever they may be. We might have the primary language, maybe the secondary language in English, and then a picture format of the menu where people can point to communicate, because the language barrier is one that, you know, there's no chance at sound communication otherwise.
What about the copy? So the wording that we see on menus, and I'm just going to run a theory by you that I've just made up. But it seems to me that the more expensive the restaurant menu, the fewer words there are on it. And maybe this is a UK thing, but it will say aubergine, sage. And they might even, you know, you mentioned $15.95, so it might just be $15. And so they seem to strip it back. But then equally, in the lower end, that's very short and sweet as well. So it'll say burger and fries or hot dog, whatever. And then it seems to me, and again, I'm completely making this up, it's the area in the middle where there seems to be a lot of convincing to be done. And there'll be lots of talk about the locally sourced organic produce and, you know, where it's come from, the story behind it. Is there anything in that, or am I just kind of making assumptions here?
You're spot on. And I think that there's value. You know, I look for alignment when I look at a menu. So if I'm working with a client, you know, at this high-end restaurant, sometimes what we'll end up seeing is a really fine steak on the menu. Let's say a dry age, 28-day dry age T-bone steak. You know, they might have it on the menu, 28-day dry age T-bone, 16 ounces, $58. And that's it. And then you read about their cheeseburger, and their cheeseburger is a grass-fed beef with bib lettuce, tomato, heirloom tomato, and sliced red onion. This aioli, right? And it's this beautiful description about the burger. But when you compare the two, if you were just judging it based on the length of the copy alone, you say, this must be a burger restaurant that also serves steaks. You know, when in fact, that's a steakhouse that has for some reason programmed themselves to write these really fancy burger descriptions. And then these higher costing, higher value items, we just are very bare minimum with that. So for me, that's when a menu can be out of alignment, right? I'd really want to lean into the steak there and tell a little bit more of the story of where the beef was raised, who the farmers were, if we were able to have that information available.
So do restaurants come up with an idea for a meal like a $58 steak that maybe people don't order very frequently, but then in comparison, it makes other items on a menu look more reasonably priced? Whereas if you didn't have that $58 steak, then you might also think, oh, this item that's $20, actually that's quite expensive.
Absolutely. There are ways that we can use price anchors. What I encourage teams to do, though, is really have an option for people that are there celebrating something. We never know when somebody maybe just has an occasion that we want that person to be able to say, you know, we're out celebrating. Let's have a good time. We're going to go all out. We'll have a bottle of champagne and the finest things on the menu. We want to make it easy for that guest to come to our establishment and spend that money. We also, by the same token, we want to have something for the guests who they want to come here every week. They want to come multiple times a week, but they need to be able to fit that within their budget.
You're really picking up on things around emotion there as well, because you also don't want to be the person that sits in a restaurant and looks at the menu and thinks, I can't afford anything here. I've had that before, right, where I've gone somewhere quite expensive. And then you look at the wine menu and you think, oh, this is embarrassing. Yeah. I need to just, you know, reverse out of this place. And you don't want that to happen, do you?
Absolutely not. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned this. I was just out Valentine's Day, very much a couple's holiday. People do special menus to be able to serve guests for two more quickly. We help teams do that with their menus as well. I'm traveling. And so I walked into the restaurant next door to the hotel. And thankfully, the hostess told me, you know, before I sat down that, oh, by the way, there's a tasting menu tonight. It's $125 per person. I said, oh, thank you for telling
that
me
kills
now.
That kills a romance.
but thank you for telling me before I sit down. And now there's that embarrassment of like, oh, it's $125. I guess I'll get up and leave. You know, so she diffused that situation early on for me. We don't want people to feel that way. There are some restaurants that have to position themselves in that place for one reason or another. They're going after their stars or recognition, things like that, where they have to be at a certain price point. But for most of the clients that we work with that are serving the general public, they want to be able to be a place that people come to more frequently. It's actually probably one of the things that we're addressing the most when we work on menus and menu projects is how do we increase guest propensity to consumer, you know, likeliness to return.
So you're thinking about the lifetime of the customer relationship, aren't you? And I know with the menu engineers, I'm sure you have people coming to you saying, how can I sell more food? How can I sell more meals? How can I make more profits? But then if you're having a situation where that person is made to feel awkward because they took their girlfriend out on a date, they've only just got together and now they're in this situation where they've got to pay all this money, then they probably would have gone away, felt a little bit embarrassed about that. They might have said to their friends, oh, it was so embarrassing, I had this experience, and then they don't come back, do they? So how do you talk to clients about this and say let's think long term here?
I really do look at the value proposition that a restaurant's putting out, and I try to view it from the general public's perspective. If I'm a vegetarian and most of the dishes have meat, it's like, oh, just get that dish without the meat. And it's like, okay, but am I saving anything by doing so? You know, no. So I'm really losing value and I'm eating at your restaurant as a vegetarian. So I'll say, chef, you've got to come up with some better vegetarian options. So I really try to put myself in the position of every single guest that we may have, give them, that particular guest, a reason to want to come to the restaurant. Even if a restaurant might not be vegetarian or vegan focused, if they take the time to separate and create a separate menu that these are all our vegetarian friendly or vegan friendly options on a separate menu, it makes it so special for that one guest who comes in who is vegetarian. You know, let's say 1 in 20 or 1 in 30 guests who that's their diet, they stick to it, and that restaurant's taking the time to produce a menu specifically for them. It's like a nice warm hug at the table to say, you know, we care about you and here's your special menu.
Let's switch the focus away from food for a moment and think of a different type of menu. Netflix, the world's largest streaming platform with 260 million users. When it comes to offering choice, they have thousands and thousands of movies and TV series to choose from. How do you decide what to watch? And to make matters worse, you're using a smartphone or a clunky remote control with tiny little buttons that you probably can't even see in low light. Netflix know that if they don't get their user interface right, then people can't make a decision, they don't use the service, and they cancel their subscription. But a well-designed menu will have a hugely positive impact on their bottom line, which is why they invest heavily in a good user experience. It starts with the onboarding. As you sign up, you're asked what you like to watch, and the platform is busy personalising your experience while you're busy putting your credit card back in your wallet. Then there's the categorisation behind the scenes, so let's say you like Top Gun, it knows to suggest Tom Cruise and action-adventure films to you. And this personalisation even extends to the artwork on the thumbnails, so depending on your tastes, the algorithm will learn to show you something full of explosions or maybe a more romantic moment. And they do split testing on different user groups to test different interfaces, gathering masses of data that shows what audiences respond to best. There's a consistent colour scheme to guide you towards pressing particular buttons, easy, endless scrolling through large images with minimal text. And everything starts on the left, which works with a Western audience used to reading from left to right. And that prime real estate in the top left will autoplay the trailer, which is a deliberate technique called idleness aversion, keeping you busy and entertained so you don't get bored and give up altogether. It's all about removing that decision anxiety. And these things come together beautifully to help the person sat on the sofa juggling their remote control and their hot slices of pizza to move more quickly to making a decision and just getting on and enjoying the movie. So talking of hot slices of pizza, let's go back to Sean now and pick up our conversation about restaurant menus. This is also an opportunity to ask you about where it's going in the future. So in the past, we've been so used to talking to waiters and waitresses, and they come up and take our order, and then we ask them about their favourite choices and that kind of thing. And then the pandemic has just seen these huge shifts. So the different regulations around hygiene and wearing masks and socially distancing. And then in this time, we saw a big increase in deliveries. So we weren't even going to restaurants as well. And I wondered what you've seen has been the impact on menus as a result of all of this.
It is a very fascinating time to be in the menu world right now. Obviously, in the pandemic, we saw this big pendulum swing into digital menus, one-time use menus that we had to throw out, whether it was some government body regulating that. We also needed to be more flexible. So I think some things that are the silver lining of the pandemic, I guess, would be that restaurateurs learned that they need to be more agile with their menus, they need to be able to adapt more quickly. We saw a lot of price fluctuations. For us here in the States, chicken wings was something that was almost, you know, astronomical in the swings that it made week to week.
Why was that then, do you think?
It's just supply chain. We know, who really knows, but just seeing the prices of what people were paying, you know, some people went from close to paying nearly 3.5 times the amount that they were initially paying just a couple of years back. We try not to put market price on a menu. When people don't know what the price is, they tend not to order it. Leaner menus is something that we're going to continue to see. I think this focus on, hey, what do we do really well at our restaurant? I grew up in New Jersey, which is famous for their New Jersey diners, which are known for having menus that are pages and pages long with 150 or 200 items on that. And I would say that even some diners have had to tighten up their menus, you know.
What are those differences for you then? Are you being asked to design for smartphones as well as print? Because I know myself, it just feels a little bit more functional and transactional in a way. And someone might have it on their phone, they're passing it over to you and you're kind of trying to scroll through together. So it's a very different experience, isn't it, compared to having a print menu that you're leafing through at your leisure?
It is definitely a different experience. I would say to another result of the pandemic was our attention spans have really cut down in time. When I started with Greg in 2015, we basically said you had about 60 to 90 seconds of a guest's attention when they sit down at your restaurant and open up the menu for the first time. We could cut that in half, maybe even less so, maybe 30 seconds. We'd be happy to get 30 seconds of a guest's undivided attention. And some guests are going to be making their decisions in that first 7 to 10 seconds when they look at a menu because they're just like, whether they're overwhelmed, had a long day or whichever it is, you know. Other guests are still, you know, there to read the menu. They'll evaluate every option that we put in front of them. But in most cases, I'd say that the time window that we have for people to find something that they love is much smaller.
How do you feel about that as a designer? So you've spent all these years designing menus. Do you feel it's a bit like with vinyl, how we used to have such beautiful record sleeves and, you know, gatefold and they'd open up and everything. And now then it moved to CD and now it's so digital. Do you feel like there's a bit of an art to menu design being lost?
That is a wonderful analogy. You just hit on something that I had not really thought of in that way before, which is when bands, you know, like let's just use the Beatles, for example, right? They would create and craft an album and it was an entire album and a journey. And experience to the whole album, right? Everything, every song, every track was so thought out. And, you know, somewhere along the way, whether it was in the 90s with MTV or what it was, it all became about the singles, the hit singles. I think that social media for us has sort of exacerbated that a little bit with Instagram. I hate telling a chef that they've got to think about what's Instagrammable on their menu. And not every restaurant is in this position, but restaurants that are slow, you know, they do have to think about how is this going to show up on these other channels like social media, because it can have such a big difference in, you know, one 30-second little clip of video or 7-second video could change the performance and life cycle for a business pretty significantly. So what are those menu items that people are talking about, I think there's a little bit more focus on that. Just like, you know, more about what's that single, that hit single that somebody would go to rather than the necessarily the whole album. Now, don't get me wrong. There's plenty of chefs who are still composing wonderful albums for us to enjoy, but sometimes those might get lost amongst the hit singles for some restaurants.
And then with that, there's so many opportunities. So one thing I really like seeing is, say, a small cafe. So simple, such a great technique. They might have a chalkboard behind the counter or one that stands outside the shop. And it's such a simple technique. Take a picture of that, put it on Instagram. And then people are already thinking, oh, that looks amazing. I think I'll come in. So it's interesting because we're pulling back in certain areas, but then there's all these opportunities as well to use Instagram and other things to promote your restaurant. One thing I was going to ask you about, I saw some really interesting research recently about touchscreens. So let's say you're feeling really hungry, but you know if you go into McDonald's and you order two Big Macs and you've got to shout because it's quite a noisy restaurant, you're going to feel a bit embarrassed about doing this, so you probably just stick with one. And one thing that McDonald's has noticed is that since introducing touchscreens as a result of the pandemic and hygiene and everything else, then people are ordering more food because they can do it quietly, so no one else around them knows they're ordering two Big Macs. Have you seen any trends like this as well, like the way the impact on customers and the way that they order as a result of all the changes that we've seen in recent years?
It's a fantastic question. And McDonald's is going to have the boatload of data here to show this. Yes, spend is likely to increase when people have it readily available to them. Again, it's easier. People are comfortable with it. There are some people that do this really well with that kiosk interaction. And by the same token, there are many that don't do it well, where that is a very clunky user experience on the phone or on the kiosk. I would say that McDonald's is probably in a position where they have some of the best technology to put forward in front of guests. Whereas for a lot of restaurants, like again, here in the States, back to 70%, 68% of restaurants being independent restaurants, they don't have the IT team that McDonald's has to really perfect that. They might still be on a legacy point of sale cash register system from 15 years ago. And just trying to make that work with a simple phone order is enough of a tall task. So for a majority of the industry, that technology, while it's available, they are working within someone else's box, whereas McDonald's is able to create the box that's best for them. So technology can be a very difficult thing. And it goes from the smallest restaurant up to the biggest global chains too, can sometimes struggle with technology and in interesting ways too.
Yeah, I mean, one example, when I have been out in the UK with friends and then you've got to do the thing where you scan the QR code, then you've also got to get on the Wi-Fi first so your phone works and all of that. And there's all these little obstacles that maybe the person designing it isn't really considering because they're not in the room in a restaurant with you at the same time. So that can be a bit fiddly, or your battery dies on your phone or any of those other things that come up.
It's my subtle reason why people bring menu engineers is for that menu therapy moment to have that conversation. So in our work, and this is just a very small plug, but just to explain what it is we boil people's menus down to what we call the bones. So when we will take someone's menu, we actually make black and white photocopies of it to pull the color off, right? It's taking some of their branding away so they don't get lost in color. And we cut up their menu into pieces, and then we begin to talk about how we want to rebuild it, right? We boil it down to the bones. But that is a disarming practice for us. And people walk into our workshops and they're like, are we doing an arts and crafts project? It's like we're in grade school, you know, like elementary school. And it's like, yeah, we kind of are. There's stickers and I have candy on the table and it's a fun experience. But it allows the IT team to talk to the operations team, to talk to marketing, who all have different, we're all working towards the same thing, but sometimes that can be very misaligned. And it's so fascinating for me because I get to come in for 1 week at a time and I get these little glimpses of these, again, global companies down to independent mom and pop shops and see a wide variety of skill sets in between and experience sets as well.
So what are those things that you would say? So anyone listening to this, you've seen lots of trends come and go and the industry changing and all of that. But what are those things that you think will still persist, those approaches that you know work with menu design?
simplicity. People always enjoy simplicity. There's research out there that shows that guests, if they order the same thing, that they come to your restaurant and I get the same thing every time I go because I love it there, somewhere between 8 and 9 times of that guest coming in, their consumption is going to fall off significantly. They just get fatigued from that. So we've got to be able to reset their clock, whether that's with seasonal menus, looking at the menu in a way where it's like an enjoyable process too. For some teams, it's like, we got to update the menu again. And it feels like a task. And for me, that's a representation of their culture. It's like, this should be fun. It should be exciting. That's why I bring stickers and candy, but it can be a reflection of an organization. Sometimes you get teams that are really fired up and have great systems for item creation and idea generation. And they feel like they can express themselves and be heard by a management team who is receptive to those inputs. That is usually indicative of a good company culture. We're just here to help people create the best version of their own menu for their team.
And last question then. So what do you love to see in a menu? What do you always order?
Oh, my default order, and this isn't necessarily a good thing, is usually a Reuben sandwich. Sometimes I go with like a turkey club. Lunch is my favorite meal of the day. I love like sandwiches, wraps, salad, but I kind of like the portability and the ease of use. Dinner sometimes feels like a little, like if I'm trapped in a restaurant too long, I only have one menu to look at, I get bored.
As I got off the plane and went on to enjoy my wonderful holiday in the Canary Islands, I kept thinking back to our conversation. One thing that really stuck with me that I think any business can apply to their list of products on offer is to feature a big moment, something people can choose when they want to celebrate or they do want to blow their budget. And the beauty of this is that it creates price anchoring. Something super expensive can make the other items feel more reasonably priced and you might sell more of them than you first expected. This approach works brilliantly in a restaurant trade, but it's something that everybody can apply. But what comes through more than this is really thinking about the customer, thinking carefully about visuals and copy to steer them in the right direction, but not tricking them into making choices they regret. No one wants to be coerced into choosing the crazily priced item on the menu that turns out to be made with shoddy ingredients, because not only will they not come back, but they'll tell all their friends too, and then they won't come at all. I hope you enjoyed Untangling Menus with me, Sue Keogh, and my guest, Sean Willard from The Menu Engineers. Editing and audio production on Communication Untangled is all down to Rob Burney at Made by DBM. We have all the show notes on my company website. Just head to sukio.com/podcast, sukio.com/podcast. And of course, please subscribe to Communication Untangled and give us a little like, a 5-star rating, or a glowing review while you're there. Thank you. I'm off to see what's on the menu for lunch.